This is a Decentered podcast from Rob Watson. Conversations about community media. Look out for Decentered Media on Twitter and on iTunes, or go to decentered.co.uk. So it's Thursday the 20th of June, and I'm at Internews with Rosie Parkin. So I usually start off by asking people to just explain about what you do, what your background is, and what you do at Internews.
Thank you. Okay, so I have been with Internews for about just under 2 years. Prior to joining Internews, I worked for the BBC's international development charity, BBC Media Action, for a decade, initially working on projects in Africa and then later taking a sort of policy research role focused on trying to improve the quality of the work that we were doing, but also improve the quality of our evaluations of that work. Before that, I ran a prison radio station in Wandsworth Prison, and before that, I ran an RSL in West London at the now unfortunately disappeared Riverside Studios, which was an absolutely amazing experience and really turned me on to the value of community radio. We had an RSL license running for a month. Riverside Studios was an arts venue that was kind of always full of people doing interesting creative things, and we worked with 300 local young people to bring them in and make programming about the arts events that they were witnessing and wouldn't necessarily otherwise have had access to, and to see their confidence grow over the course of the month as they stood in front of the microphones and told the world what they thought was extraordinary. And I became very interested not only in the process of making community radio, but also in the fact that the quality of it easily stood up against what we might consider to be kind of mainstream broadcasting. And the stories were so fantastic. And when a young person interviews another young person, the stuff that gets said is very different to what they would say to a journalist. And I heard amazing stories and loved listening to what they were producing. And that got me very excited about this sector.
So what's the thread that kind of runs through those three, those different elements, is it?
Probably stories. I've been very privileged in that I guess the work that I've done has exposed me to communities that are different to where I come from, to people who are very different from me. And I think that's, whether that be countries in which I've worked overseas or communities in the UK, I think that's probably what's driven me is that kind of exposure. I love radio, and I guess that's another thread.
So what's the storytelling process then? Just kind of explain what you've learned, what you bring about that. It's kind of, what does that do? Which is when you're empowered to tell your own stories, I suppose, isn't
it?
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, so many different things. I'm very conscious that there's a kind of movement around sort of within psychology about the power of narrative and a person's, the strength that a person kind of gets from being able to understand their own story and tell their own story and maybe even change their own narrative. Everybody has a story, and I was very conscious that we weren't necessarily hearing everybody's stories. When it comes to the sort of research-based work I've been doing, or the evidence generation work that I've been doing around the value of the projects that I've been involved in, nothing beats somebody talking about how exposure to a project impacted upon them. And so I suppose there's a storytelling angle to that as well. I'm very interested in the way that social change happens. I'm very interested in the role that the media has played in social change, whether for good or ill. I think sort of study of the media has historically been undervalued, and yet, you know, I think we recognise that the media has, what in whatever form it takes, has an incredibly influential role in our lives.
So media and social change, and positive and negative, give us an example of what you think are some of the challenges that are we're having to deal with at the moment. Why, you know, to advocate for a kind of empowered self-narrative point of view, and why is that important? Why is that necessary? What is making that more important now?
Yeah, I'll try and answer that. So I did some research last year about so the Joseph Rowntree are doing some work around trying to kind of amplify the experience of people living in poverty, and I think it's really fascinating. They have been working with Frameworks, which is an organization which helps organizations frame their messages in a way that will resonate with audiences that they're not necessarily currently engaging with. But the piece that I was looking at was around why is it that if you look at the statistics, poverty in this country is absolutely on the increase. It's very difficult to deny that. Conservative politicians have been able to do that because there are different ways of measuring poverty, but it's, you just need to look around. I mean, it's like, open your eyes, you can see food banks, you can see people living on the street. It just feels like a massive issue for our country that has been clearly has been overlooked, partly because of Brexit taking up all the airtime, but also just I think because there's no political, it's politically advantageous to ignore it. And I started looking into, well, why is it that the media isn't reporting on this to the extent that they should? And a lot of it appeared to be around the way that journalists working in the mainstream media, this is about their connection to people experiencing poverty or their lack of connection to those communities and those individuals. And that stops them reporting on them because they don't actually have anybody to interview. They're not close enough to the action to see what's happening and see what the stories are. There's a big lack of trust in terms of there's shame associated with experiencing poverty that makes people less inclined to put themselves in the public eye. There have obviously been numerous instances where reality TV programs have, whether intentionally or not, ended up sort of demonizing people living in poverty. And it just occurred, so much of it is about social networks. And increasingly, it seems that with fewer resources to play with, journalists are not out there where they need to be in the communities that they should be reporting on, finding those stories and representing those communities. And there, of course, we move over to community radio and the value that could, that's one of the values that community media can bring.
So it seems like there's a kind of perfect storm, isn't there, of negative, you know, the spiral downwards of there's technical change, which for profitable reasons, commercial companies want to improve their efficiency so that everything gets centralized and automated. there's also a kind of a cultural change in terms of the type of people who, you know, can access and can take up the role of a reporter or a journalist, mm-hmm. coming from a more restricted background,
absolutely.
Class
There's
background,
no
that kind of thing.
Yeah. So how, you have to pay to become a journalist,
and you have to do unpaid internships, yeah, and you
absolutely.
Have to perhaps live in London
absolutely.
To do that as well.
Yeah.
And then the other one is the kind of, you know, the, so that you've got this centralization model, you've got this consolidation model, and then you've got a kind of political denial as well, as you just indicated, of evidence bases. And what is justifiable as an evidence base, which is kind of all this is kind of swirled around in terms of kind of the political and also the economic, if you like, that has kind of created a potential point where I wouldn't want to be a Pollyanna and say that the roof's about to fall in, but I don't think people are happy with what they've got and how their world is being described to mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. So there's then, mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. the combination of social media and other new emerging forms of individual communication, it's kind of taken, you know, it's distracted people from saying, no, actually, a kind of collective social community voice hasn't been given priority, if you like.
Exactly. I mean, that's so beautifully put, because, of course, at the advent of social media, everyone was very optimistic about the way that this could give people voice and amplify voice and put the tools in people's hands. And it's interesting to reflect on, you know, this is a very ill-formed thought, so maybe best not to broadcast this, but so people have been able to express themselves. Mainstream newspapers have comment sections. There, in one sense, it feels like there's a lot more room, a lot more space for people to air their views. So why is it that we see such toxicity in that public space? Is it because we've kind of let it run wild, or we've given people the impression that their views are, that they can share their views without those views necessarily being able to have any impact? So the political processes haven't really changed in order to kind of accommodate that voice. So people are given the impression they're able to share their views, and maybe over the years those views have become more extreme or more frustrated because there isn't actually the structure to make that real. So you can express your view on a platform in a way that perhaps you couldn't before on a public platform, but that doesn't necessarily change what's actually happening. And in fact, your quality of life and the fortunes of your community is actually declining. So that must be very confusing for people.
And those platforms are actually designed to promote that level of, you know, clickbait, you know, so people express frustration and indignation and extreme views. And that's what drives, you know, the algorithms, and they're the things that get promoted. So the kind of confirmation of, you know, kind of nice things that people want to talk about and share don't get the priority.
Absolutely. And you know, you were talking about sort of deliberative democracy. I don't know anything about this, but I imagine that it only really works, has it ever worked anywhere, where there are sort of rules about how those debates take place. And, you know, where I would say that I think editorial, kind of robust editorial values have a place is in when, doesn't always happen, but in theory, when you see debates taking place on a public platform which are properly moderated and where there are rules of engagement, which in theory or should enable a constructive discussion to take place. And of course, we see in the public realm that that's not necessarily happening, but those are the principles which I do think have some value. So I agree, yes. So then the impression is given that everybody on social media is kind of saying extreme things or hateful things. And of course, that normalizes the practice of doing that. And then suddenly you've got this very toxic environment, which people no longer want to be in. So where do they go now?
I think one of the things about, you know, the trying to get across to people what the definitions of community media are, or, you know, the kind of the informant principles, if you like, is the one thing which is often missing is the level of accountability. And, you know, the former, you know, it's kind of waxed lyrically about the, you know, kind of newspapers 30 years ago, but reporters generally lived in the communities, as you said earlier, lived in the communities, walked the same streets, bought things in the same shops, talked to the same priests and vicars and, you know, kind of the public, you know, landlords and things like that in that same community. And now there's a disconnection from that where the pressure is to just regurgitate press releases or to grab things from Google, and you don't have local photographers anymore, that kind of stuff. So that kind of hollowing out has happened. But what has not been on our commercial media, and I would perhaps argue to some extent the BBC as well, has a crisis of accountability. And you said trust is the big issue, and the other side of trust is accountability. Well, it's a triangle, isn't it? Trust, accountability, responsibility. Because you've got a profession, and some might call that an elite of people. Don't like really using those terms, but it's there. And they are acting on behalf of people rather than enabling people to act for themselves.
Absolutely. And you know, maybe that has always been the case. I'm not really sure. I mean, you describe the kind of reporter within the community, very close to the action, presumably having a sense of responsibility towards that community, wanting to represent that community and its interests. And of course, community, there are multiple interests within that. So I don't know. Maybe it was always a slightly paternalistic role. I'm not sure. But certainly the lack of kind of geographical and social proximity is really problematic.
So reflecting on your experience of the projects that you've worked on, so then they take out that middle layer, don't they? You're encouraging people to speak directly for themselves within the project and to learn the responsibility of telling their own stories.
I think there's a bit of both. I mean, as an Internews, we also support actually, I like your word, reporters, and we have a very broad definition, because we know that in lots of places people are providing public service content or information that we believe adheres to certain values around accuracy and objectivity, and they may not be
like, it's dangerous to be called a journalist, potentially.
That's true. And yeah, and some of the work that we're doing is around representing or at least advocating for the issue that increasingly journalists in lots of places are under great threat because of the work that they're trying to do. And so we have to hold that sort of dimension in mind too. So that I think there's a bit of everything, really, isn't there? I think there's supporting those who call themselves reporters or have decided to take on that role, and ensuring that they can be secure in doing their work, that they're well prepared to do their work, that they have access to the training that they want, that they have access to the resources that they need to do that, their jobs. That's really important. But also, you know, in the end, their jobs are about creating public space or contributing to a public space in which people who are not reporters and not engaged in content provision are also able to have their say. So that interactivity element is always going to be really important. You have to help people come to that. You know, you can't just, otherwise, if you create a space, invite people in, only the most vocal and most confident will come in. So how do you create a space that's inclusive and really helps those who might be less comfortable representing themselves and their views? And that has become so, it's always been important, but it feels like a very, it feels more important than ever now in the UK.
The question that comes to my mind, I kind of jotted this down, was the it is that question, isn't it, of whose news are we talking about?
Absolutely.
And who defines what news is? What's of interest to me might not be of interest to anybody else. But if the pattern of things that happen to me, you know, access to buses or bin collections or wherever it is repeated and replicated in a neighborhood, but then it's also replicated elsewhere, then that becomes news. And it's kind of how we where and how we define it. The challenges, I think, with the changes in technology that can redistribute and decentralize that process. So it's kind of, what would you think would be the kind of approach to, if you like, news literacies, media literacies, and where and how do we need to spread those around? Yeah. And in what form do you think in the future?
It's really interesting. I have not really seen, I know that there are lots of organizations working on media literacy, and first and foremost, I think there needs to be a lot more coordination around that, because it feels like people are trying things. What is the curriculum for media literacy? Are we agreed on that? And if we are agreed on that, then it needs to be built into schools from the youngest age. Things that I've always observed, sort of long before social media, that the involvement in producing your own media, as the young people that I worked with did, was the best way of sort of grasping media literacy and news literacy. Once you understand, once you're forced to think about whether somebody you're interviewing is, you know, they may be very impassioned, they may be, you may be kind of finding yourself in an interview situation where you're very sort of taken up with what they're saying, but you still have to step back and get the alternative view. And I think that's, for anybody, that's a really important process to go through, and you only really embed that thinking when you do it yourself. We can't necessarily, or maybe we can, maybe all young people in school could take a course in reporting, and that to me would be a really effective way of...
It's interesting, because, and I've said this publicly elsewhere, so it's no surprise to anybody who hears this, is I'm very sceptical of the Ofcom media literacies model. Which is very consumer-based, and it's almost on the point of view that their level of... I sat through a presentation yesterday, which was about the adult media literacies report, and it's very much, can you tell the difference between a fake and a genuine consumer site for buying trainers or something? Can you tell the difference between an advert and a promoted post and not? And can you tell the difference between a real news site and a fake news site? And it doesn't include... a model of media participation based on self-empowerment and production of your own stories. It's very kind of passive consumer-based, choosing a mobile phone contract. And that strikes me as being quite limited in its work.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it has its value for sure, because at the end of the day, that is how many people are engaging with the internet. So you need to have it in there. But I agree, it's a bit back to civic values and what, you know, I don't want to be, again, this sounds very paternalistic, but we want people to participate. We want people to have the tools to participate. We want people to feel that they can, because if we do not get to the stage where most people feel like they can participate in their lives and communities, then we've got a real problem. So I guess that's partly to your to sort of consumer focus. It's rather passive, isn't it? Mm. And I don't think there's anything wrong with trying to sort of stimulate engagement and support routes for people to be engaged in their communities and their lives. That's really important.
Really like this for the kind of civic values approach. What do you mean by that? And because we don't often get the, it's in all of the kind of consideration of these things, we often don't get the opportunity to just let go of what we've got and all the angst mm-hmm. and anxiety mm-hmm. and project a little mm-hmm. bit further forward and say, this is the kind of society we'd like to be.
Nobody's doing that right now. I mean, I think that's the most painful part of everything that's been happening over the last couple of years, is that I don't see anyone putting forward a positive vision for what the future could look like. I mean, obviously, and I think there's great anxiety. This is also very ill-formed thinking, but generally, do we not want people for the most part to feel that they have a role to play, a useful role to play, that they have some, that the more active they are, the more ability they have to influence their circumstances, the circumstances of people around them. People must have agency. We have to give people agency.
Well, people have agency, but we don't let them express it sometimes, do we?
Yeah, it could be that, and I think that's maybe part of the issue, that we've increasingly people have the platform, or they have a platform, but there's no connection between that platform and what's actually happening in the political sphere, in local government, in accountability, in you know, there's no connection between what I say and how loudly I say it and how often I say it and whether that actually makes any difference.
And privilege produces a number of types of people who probably have a more articulate voice in these circumstances than others.
I think that's a very big issue. I think that's a massive issue, actually, that I'm afraid we've not really moved on, or we're moving backwards in terms of the who we see in public life and how. And maybe the more communication platforms we have access to and the more sophisticated public communication becomes, again, it is increasingly the preserve of people who've almost been educated in order to, who have been educated in order to hold that microphone and hold it well. And that's
teaching confidence. I'm struck by one of the things that, you know, the public-private schools debate is often based around private schools teach confidence, and that if only state schools taught that confidence, then the world would be sorted. But confidence is not this kind of elixir, is it?
In fact, it's dangerous,
because you can have these very confident people who make very poor decisions.
Does that sound familiar? But that's the issue, isn't it? That I think, again, it's
and it's given voice to the small doubts and those people in our communities who, you know, I always say, you know, in 2008 at the financial crisis, it wasn't caused by a lack of clever people. There are lots of clever people, all highly educated, and perhaps a few voices that kind of said, I don't understand this, might have been something that, you know, moderated some of the excesses a bit.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's a bit emperor's new clothes, isn't it? That no one really seemed willing to say, this is really problematic what's happening here. The way that these are being bundled up, all these loans are being bundled up, just smells wrong. I mean, everyone just, no one wants to be that person in the room who's
you then get shunned and shunted out of the game,
absolutely,
kind of thing. And
absolutely,
it's a narrower and narrower, smaller and smaller game that more and more people are doing alternative things and are not playing by the standard. And the danger is, I suppose, is that if you don't have an open, accountable social process, Then what you do is you push people into the margins, mm-hmm. and they go underground, and you see the kind of, you know, the radicalization that you mm-hmm. get through,
absolutely,
you know, the YouTube challenge, all
absolutely.
That kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
And if there's that element of transparency and engagement and discussion and listening to each other and learning from each other, I mean, maybe we're too optimistic and idealistic.
No, but we have to have some kind of vision, and it can happen, and it has worked. And I think the issue is that it happens on a kind of micro scale. I mean, I walked through a shopping centre in Stratford about 3 months ago, and I can't remember the name of the organisation, but they basically just set up round tables in shopping centres, and they, as people walk past, they pull them in to sit down and talk. And it's a very, you know, it's a moment. The people who sat down and engaged with it will not be forever changed by that process, but you could tell by the look on their faces that they were like, this is new, and we're having a debate, and I'm forced to look in the eye of the person that I'm disagreeing with. And I think that really changes the tone, the respect, the trust, the willingness to entertain an alternative point of view. That's really crucial.
It's kind of intersubjectivity, isn't it? You
yeah.
put yourself in somebody else. Why is that person so angry and het up about
exactly.
this?
Okay,
you know, kind of,
exactly.
You know, okay, there's something there, but you just kind of have to talk it through a bit.
Exactly. There's no doubt that arguing with people on social media is just that the anonymity is really sort of dangerous, in terms of I'm just gonna say stuff that I would never say to somebody's face, and then they're gonna come back at me in a really aggressive and angry way, understandably. That's not a healthy debate.
So in your kind of past experience of working on different projects, then, if there's been a challenge of let's call it accountability, how's that kind of played out? Is that something that you've learnt that from you know, it's like a value, but it's also something that comes through in terms of you have to manage that process.
Yeah,
you have to help guide and facilitate
yeah,
people.
Absolutely.
What kind of things stand out from your past experience
in terms of what works?
Yeah.
I mean, I think you do need to take moderation very seriously, and you have to find a way to allow different perspectives to be aired and create room for them, ensure that one doesn't dominate. Ideally, you can bring people onto, I'm thinking very much in terms of kind of radio programs or TV programs, but you can bring people onto those programs who are able to respond and be responsive and say, I appreciate that your community is dealing with this thing and I will look into it. And of course, then there has to be a follow-up, and we need to make sure that that wasn't just kind of empty words. But it's been interesting working in countries where, when I was at the BBC, we tried to kind of export the question time. And I think we thought it was working beautifully because it's all very flashy and it's, I mean, I think it's performative. It's kind of like, oh, everybody's here answering each other's questions. And actually, in reality, it wasn't very constructive. And what people really wanted was quite often the political figure or the official who was in the spotlight didn't actually have the power to change the thing that he or she was being asked about. And actually, what would have been much more useful would have been a sort of more deliberative process of kind of, well, this guy can't solve this problem alone. So what do we as a community, how do we want to deal with it? What are the different options? What are the policy options? A bit more towards the kind of solutions journalism focus that I haven't really seen fulfill its potential, but I think is a really interesting model and a useful model for the times that we're in today.
I mean, I taught media students for about 20 years, and it became very much about the skills that you need to get into the industry and less about the problem solving mm-hmm. and the values and the accountability that
yeah.
you need if you are a journalist or a reporter or a media producer. And it's almost as if we need to put an element in there of civic deliberation, debate, facilitation,
yeah.
rather than just telling other people's stories on their behalf.
Yeah, and I think with this business of kind of telling other people's stories on their behalf, I think that's a really important one to bear in mind, because once you insert the mediator, there is always, you know, I think many reporters try very hard to ensure that they're representing a person's point of view as they would wish to represent it.
But there's massive industrial challenges, isn't there, in that system?
And so there's always going to be an element of interpretation, and you kind of need that. I mean, it's like researchers, you kind of need that. I mean, reporters have to put things in context. They have to explain the wider significance of one person's story. I believe that that is an important role to play, because they're helping the public understand why this story is being told.
And for when you're putting things into the record of the record of social life, that is massively important, but it still misses out on that element there of that kind of element, that social community element, if you like, of people framing their experience for themselves.
Yeah, I agree. And so I suppose, I mean, I know that I've heard from lots of journalists this kind of mantra about I'm not here to drive social change. I am here to report on what's happening, and if something happens as a result of that, that's all well and good, but that's not my job, and actually I want to distance myself from that. And that's fair enough to some extent, not true, but and obviously you do have campaigning journalism where it's very much about highlighting particular issues over others. There's always an editorial agenda. You are always deciding whether one issue is more important than another, but there's no reason why you can't team up the process of reporting with a space in which people can reflect on that story, however it is presented, and that seems a very useful thing for the media writ large to do that doesn't happen enough.
It's kind of like, you know, a lot of local newspapers are under such pressure, and the journalists are under such pressure to produce a certain amount of stories, and they found, you know, the models are that kind of a clickbait approach works, and they get to drive their web traffic through, and they're being paid on the basis of how many clicks that they get, and they're manipulating social profiles, and they're using all the kind of the kind of fairly nefarious techniques that come with social media. But you know, I mean, for me in Leicester, it's a city of 300,000 people. So there's 300,000 stories there that aren't getting told, because you're just regurgitating the press releases and what will rank you in the website rankings, not necessarily in what's the experience of the story. So journalists, almost, we need to think about a lot of social organisations start with a theory of change, and journalists are saying that they're excluded. You know, we don't have a theory of change, but of course you have a theory of change. You're part of social change.
And
actually news and information reporting is one of the drivers of social change at the moment.
Absolutely. And I am sure, maybe I only know, frankly, I only know lefty journalists, but if you report on an issue and that gets wider traction, maybe one day there's even some policy change as a result of your bringing that issue to the table, then of course you're going to, I would imagine, you're going to feel good about that. So you're definitely contributing to a social change ecosystem, aren't you? And it's very difficult to separate out, well, what was the role that your story played versus some stuff that a CSO organisation might be doing versus that particular politician, local politician, was interested anyway versus, a range of different things that might all contribute to an issue becoming more salient, I suppose. But
so sum up for me then what your principles might be for community media in terms of, with all of that we just discussed. What kind of a headline, three bullet points or something like that?
I mean, I would really like to see the community media sector sort of just be given its rightful place within the wider media and information and communication. I will include communication because I think there is a hell of a lot of communication taking place, which we don't necessarily, which is in the media space and which people are consuming, which is not necessarily coming from reporting or community media. It's coming from corporates or NGOs. We just have to recognise that that's out there too, and that sometimes community media would be looking at the local level impacts of a national story, but not always. Sometimes it would be deriving, mostly it would be deriving kind of local stories that have local relevance, and maybe they don't have any relevance for anybody else. Maybe it is really only just for this small community that this thing matters, but it matters to them more than the national level stuff because it's impacting on their lives every day. And there's no reason why a well-resourced community media outlet, community radio station, hyper-local, I mean, I defer to you guys to work in the definitions there. There is no reason why that entity, that group of people, could not have a considerable impact on the lives of the people living around it that it serves, whether that be providing a space for people to come together and discuss. You know, I think the physical presence of community media is really, really important. And I can see, I was very struck, I'm slightly going off tangent here, but I was very struck at GFM about the fact that they're sort of geographically remote. And and whilst they are next to a restaurant that people come to, I think it does impact on their ability to draw in the local community and to have more people coming through the doors, and more people handing over the microphone between shows to people who are very different from them, which I think is a massive value of community media. So I hope through this process we're going to be able to understand concrete ways to give community media that status and to make its role without, of course, community media is extremely diverse and it's not trying to make it all uniform and operate to the same model, but just to recognise that within every information ecosystem, there are layers, there's national, there's regional, there's local, there's hyper-local, and needs, information needs and participation needs are different at all those layers and all need to be served. And no one but community media can really do it at that local level.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. That's perfect. Yes, that's great. If anybody wants to get in touch with you, if they listen to this at some point, what's the best way? It's Internews.
What's the best way to do it?
Twitter user?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. I'm just trying to remember my handle. I think it's Rosie_Parkin, P-A-R-K-Y-N. And yeah, that's probably the best way. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. Yeah. And I'm on Decentered Media as ever. And this... probably going to be on iTunes. Just look for Decentered Media or visit decentered.co.uk. But thank you very much. You've been listening to the Decentered podcast. I'm Rob Watson. If you want to find out more information, contact me on Decentered Media via Twitter or go to decentered.co.uk.